SCO Saturday Special on your favorite radio station in the Monterey Bay Area in Central California. We're going to have a really different kind of program today because I met an interesting famous person last weekend, and he's going to be our guest, so do stay with us.
Good morning. Now stay right here on KSCO Radio.
Ever wanted yourself or your kid to be a child star? Not a good idea, according to Paul Peterson, and he knows. You remember Paul as Jeff Stone, the son on the Donna Reed Show on TV in the 50s and 60s. He was also a Mouseketeer on the Mickey Mouse Club and had roles in numerous motion pictures. Paul is nearly 60 now and is running an organization he founded called A Minor Consideration, an advocacy group for kid actors present and past. We've all heard stories of former child stars falling on hard times with drugs, suicide, and a myriad of other personal problems. But Paul is doing something about what is a much greater problem than most believe. Did you know that child labor laws are not enforced with respect to the acting profession and that many of the presumed rich and famous are actually broke and famous? Talk to and get to know Paul Peterson, our guest on the next KSCO special this Saturday, 10 a.m. to 12 noon, right here on your Count on Us to Keep You Stimulated and Fascinated Without Drugs or Steroids, but maybe with Nutritional Supplements Radio, AM 1080 KSCO. So excited. I've never talked to a Mouseketeer before. Well, let's get the row on the showed here. Hey, Paul Peterson.
How are you, Michael?
I'm doing well, doing well. I'm so excited. I've never talked to a Mouseketeer before. Well, actually, I guess I did, you know, a week ago when I first met you, I guess.
Yes, it was just a week ago. That's correct, at the Hot August Nights up in Reno.
Isn't that a great... Is that the first time you've been to that?
That is the first time. Now, I'm a big car buff, and I've gone to a lot of, you know, street fairs that feature rock and roll and cars, but that was really spectacular. What a great time my wife and I had.
I try to make it there every year. It's what is it, 8 or 9 days long, and I only made it to the last, you know, day or two. And it's a fabulous event, and it's really neat because not only you get to see the old cars, but you get to see the rock and roll bands, and you get to see people, you know, who were stars.
Well, exactly. You know, as you saw, we had the folks from American Graffiti, the movie. That was fun. And then, of course, I got to sit down with my buddies who were part of A Minor Consideration, from Ken Osmond, Eddie Haskell, and Frank Banks, who was Lumpy,
from
The Beaver.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, a lifetime friend, Johnny Provost, from Lassie.
Who lives up here, actually, in Northern California,
That's
right?
Correct, yes. He's closer to you than I.
Uh-huh. So, golly gee, tell us about how you got into movies and television. How did that happen?
Well,
did you have a stage mom?
I try to tell people the truth about this experience. It has served me well. I got into show business because my mom was bigger than me. I mean, it's just that straightforward. People have to understand that however a talent, however much a child with talent may want to get into the business, it requires the participation of adults. And in my case, my mom, when we moved from Iowa back to North Hollywood, always had her eye on show business for me. That's why I took all those singing and dancing and piano lessons and trombone and drums, et cetera, et cetera. And wouldn't you know it, fate gave me this opportunity to go to an open audition in the spring of 1955. And I was there with 5,000 kids for some new creature called a Mouseketeer.
I mean, really, 5,000?
Oh, I'm not making that up. You should see open calls here in Hollywood. They're even larger today in 2005. But in that time, there were 2,500 young females, 2,500 young boys. We were on two sound stages, which we filled. And they had the open audition in which you sang and danced. And just like on Broadway, if you weren't very talented, in about four bars, some disembodied voice would say, "Thank you, next."
Uh-huh.
Well, I got to perform my entire number at that time, and which was Lulu's Back in Town, and I was hired.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
And how long did that last?
Well, 7 weeks.
I love this story.
Well, I am the world's first ex-mouseketeer because I was the first kid that was fired.
For?
Conduct unbecoming a mouse.
What was that conduct?
Well, I had no idea that kid actors are not supposed to be children. I, of course, subsequently learned that. But that is the honest truth. The profession, no matter what your age, requires a sort of discipline that, frankly, I didn't have. Just to give you an idea how ill-prepared I was, my third-grade teacher, Miss Carnes, said of my behavior, mind you, this is on a report card that had all A's on it, Paul's behavior is abominable.
Well, I mean, what did you do that was so abominable?
Well, everything. You know, I didn't much like the kids who spent too much time looking in the mirror. When they said, hey, you've got 5 minutes. Now, mind you, this wasn't a school day, so, you know, you don't have to run off to the studio set school. So I would climb ladders, or I would steal the little cars that would soon appear in Tomorrowland. This is in advance of the opening of Disneyland, which happened in July 17th. 1955. Nothing was locked on the Disney lot, so you could go into the paint shop, you could go into the theater. I had a lot of fun. Trouble was, when they called for me, I wasn't always present.
Son of a gun.
Yeah, the problems began on the first wardrobe day when I went in. My real name is William Paul Peterson. That's the name I was given.
So, and you just don't use the William part.
Well, I hate William because even when I was little, the joke was, Willie pee-pee? And then I would say, no, he won't. Willie pee-pee? You know how kids are. So I hated nicknames.
Right.
And because I was so small and feisty, they called me Mouse. And I had to go one by one tell people, don't call me Mouse. And one Friday afternoon, the casting director at Disney, who's a big, heavyset fellow named Lee Travers, snuck up behind me just after lunch, tapped me on the shoulder and said, how you doing, Mouse? And I turned around and punched him in the stomach and said, don't call me that, fatso. And standing behind Mr. Travers was Walt Disney. And I was discharged.
Well, I guess that probably was contact unbefitting a mouse, I guess.
Indeed it was. Yeah. And frankly, it turned out rather well. I learned a powerful lesson.
Uh-huh.
Believe me, a lesson that became really substantial when the Mouseketeers finally debuted in late September of that year. And became an instantaneous cultural icon.
So wait a second. So you were fired before the show aired?
Oh, absolutely. I was gone.
So were you on any of them?
Oh, yeah. I participated in three shows a week for 7 weeks. So for 21 episodes thereabouts, I was present. You know, doing the skits and singing and dancing, and when they had a gymnastic show, I would climb up on top of three people. We had all sorts of things going on.
Right. And so you were like 10 years old, I guess, huh?
Nine,
okay.
That's correct.
All right. So that was the end of your short-lived Mouseketeer career.
Well, that was my Mouseketeer experience. I went on to have more Disney experiences, if you will. But as I said, the lesson was very powerful. You know, by the time I was discharged, Michael, I had gotten an agent, a lovely lady who was well known in Hollywood at that time, named Lola Moore. And before the Mouseketeers even aired in that 60 days between my discharge and their debut, I had already landed a national commercial and was starting to make the rounds with the other kid actors, and discovered that I had a knack for getting jobs. So I, you know,
so were you already sort of growing a big head at that point, or not yet?
I presume
that you ultimately did, and then it ultimately got deflated. but maybe that's not true. Maybe you're one of many who did. Maybe you're one of few who didn't, or something.
Look, I have always had perhaps an exaggerated sense of self, but you know, by this time, 9 years old, just like everybody else listening to my voice right now, the pecking order was pretty much decided. You know, if you think back, just close your eyes for a second and think back to third grade when you were 8 or 9 years old.
Yeah, the teacher hated me.
Well, but you already knew where you fit with other kids. And, Michael, when it came to singing and dancing and performing, I was pretty good. I mean, they didn't hire me for nothing.
Right.
I was already singing at the Hollywood Bowl. I won every contest you could imagine when it came to, you know, these talent shows. So I knew I could sing and dance. And, in fact, I tell people, even to this day, and they're still friends, the only two people that I thought were in my league, in fact, were better than me, was Tommy Cole, who, of course, had this fantastic voice, and Bobby Burgess, who, of course, was much older than the rest of the mice, but was one of the best dancers I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
But except for those two, I fit right in there.
So, Bobby, I was reading about him. His father-in-law, Myron Cohen, just passed on or something?
Yes, indeed he did. The wonderful accordion player. You know, who, geez, we all...
From Lawrence Welk, yeah.
Yes, and of course, Bobby had one of the greatest careers as a dancer you could possibly have.
So he must be, what, in his mid-70s now?
Mid-60s.
Yeah, that's right.
But, you know, he worked for 30 straight years as a dancer, which is most remarkable.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's amazing, huh?
And Tommy Cole, who, this is a one poignant story, because my mother and father needed me to learn the lesson of being fired from your first job, that Saturday morning, Tommy Cole and his mom came to pick me up to take me to work. And I had to go outside and tell them that I had been fired. Mm-hmm. Now, here we are 50 years later. Tommy Cole is one of our close friends and is the head of the Makeup and Hairstylist Union.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating. It sort of reminds me a little bit about me getting kicked off this radio station when I was a high schooler. I was doing the high school radio show. I got kicked off for making a fart noise on KSCO.
Isn't revenge sweet?
Right. Fortune, misfortune. It's difficult to tell, as a friend once said to me, or as frequently said to me. And I vow, I learned a very important lesson. You either conform, or if you're going to be different, you better own the place.
Well,
it's as simple as that.
You know, isn't that the truth? And as I shared with you during that hot afternoon at Hot August Nights, the same character traits that got me fired in 1955 are, in fact, the driving force behind this advocacy of mine. You know, I don't mind the
which
good
didn't
fight.
Come to you until your 40s, I think you were telling me, right?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, that's when
you
finally...
You went through some really hard times, I think, right?
Well, yes, like most kid actors, you know, the fall from the pedestal is really difficult.
Yeah, and you were in, I guess you're probably best known as Jeff in the Donna Reed Show, as I said in the promo, but you've been in, like, hundreds of roles in other TV shows and motion pictures, right?
Well, that's correct. You know, careers for kid actors, Michael, happen in the most meteoric sense, because the word quickly spreads through what is, in effect, a very small town, Hollywood, that, hey, we got a new kid around that has the goods. So I went from doing national commercials shortly after the Mouseketeer experience, things like classic commercials like Manners the Butler, if your older listeners will remember that, where the napkin keeps falling off your lap.
Yeah, and I remember Manners the Butler, yeah.
Right, when the little guy under the table, well, that was me.
Wow, for gosh sakes.
Yeah. And then I started to get work on some pretty high-profile television shows, Ford Theater, Lux Video Theater, but most important, I think, the next year, was a Playhouse 90, which got an Emmy consideration called Circle of the Day with Michael Rennie and James Mason. Oh, it was a wonderful teleplay. And I think that really solidified my reputation, even as an 11-year-old, mind you, in Hollywood. So when the next, in 1957, when the opportunity came to get a really good part on a big movie called Houseboat with Cary Grant and Sophia Loren, I was in the running from the beginning and was subsequently hired. And that was really, that was a big picture. Got a lot of attention, and I got some good reviews and rather positive comments from Mr. Grant.
And it was such a coincidence. I already told you this when we talked earlier this week, but I was going to call you early this week to firm up this interview.
Yes.
And I didn't do it on Monday, and I say, oh, my God, I'm supposed to call Paul Peterson. I'm going to do that first thing when I get up because you're an early riser. But I turned on the TV first, and it happened to be on Stars or Encore or one of those
right things.
And there was Houseboat, and there was the guy I was going to be calling in 2 minutes.
Well, you know,
is that Paul Peterson? Yeah, it is. I look closer at him.
As I said to you that morning, that is yet another example of what I persistently tell people. These images that you are so fortunate to have participated in never go away. And that's the millstone. That's the albatross that is hung on KidStars. Because it's difficult not just for us to let our past successes go. It's difficult for an audience to set aside the images they have of you as a child. And so
that's what gets you typecast.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And I was swimming in the deep end, Michael. When you do 8 years on a television series depicting the classic all-American boy, you will be known for that forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get, and yet, you got some parts as you got older, didn't you? I mean...
Oh, sure. And
yeah.
Look, I still do movies. You know, I am always delighted when someone asks me to, you know, come and participate in their project, because for me, acting is stealing money. I mean, the pay is extravagant, the work is easy, it's certainly nothing that I worry about. I mean, I know how to remember lines and hit the marks, and I'm pretty up on the technical part of the business, and there is a certain value in having a person like me on a set, because I know what I'm doing.
Jeez. Yeah, that's amazing. So how much of that do you do these days, and how much time do you spend doing the...
Well, I don't do very many television shows. You know, I spend so much time on the road with this advocacy. I do a lot of talk shows. But I've done 3 movies in the last 4 years and half a dozen television shows.
Uh-huh.
So, I get my chances.
Yeah, you still got your feet in it, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think... totally apart from a minor consideration, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
if a minor consideration hadn't happened, would you still be doing this, do you think? Or do you think...
Oh, no, no, no. Midpoint in my life to this point, I had switched over to the writing of books. You know, I've published 16 books for major publishers like Random House and Simon & Schuster. And that was the career I switched into, which sort of fits my... the life I have constructed for myself.
Is that what, in your 30s or something you did
well,
that?
Well, yeah. Actually, in my mid-20s is when I started that. My first book came out in 1971 for Simon & Schuster. And then for the next, 15, 18 years, that's how I was making my living.
Right. Okay, and then what happened? Did you go through the rough times during that time when you were making your living as an author?
Yeah, in my 20s. First of all, I was very angry and embittered. You know, I thought I had been raised and trained to be a performer, and I'd made a mark in Hollywood already, and I thought it would continue forever. Frankly, as I shared with you, I thought I was going to be, this generation's Cary Grant. That's what I thought, I was being groomed for. But it took Hollywood about 4 years to disabuse me of that notion. I was old meat and unemployable. And that generated a whole bunch of troubles internally. And I made some terrible choices, Michael. You know, drugs and alcohol and bad marriage and bad friendships and just stupid decisions, which seemed to be part of...
And who was running your financial affairs, you or someone?
Oh, me, absolutely.
Yeah?
Nobody beat me up. Nobody stole my money. It was fun being rich and famous, believe me. I just didn't realize. It was kind of like going to a really expensive dinner, that at the end of the dinner that you've enjoyed so much, somebody's going to hand you a bill. And the terrible thing about this kind of early stardom, and this is true in sports, and it's true in the entertainment business, whether you're movies or television or music, that fall is really precipitous, and nothing prepares you for it, because people have spent most of your life telling you how wonderful you are. Now, mind you, these are the people whose paychecks depend on your performance.
Yeah.
You really don't know reality. And I hit that wall, and it was a very difficult time, and it had after effects that lasted, frankly, until the age of 40, when I finally sort of sobered up and wised up and said, wait a second.
Well, what made that happen, Paul?
Well, there were several factors. Growing maturity. We all sort of age out of the drug culture, I think. Our bodies just can't do it anymore. The most important event, though, was getting sober. And the reason that happened is because I recognized that I couldn't do my life's work unless I could connect the dots every day and had my head screwed on straight.
Uh-huh.
There were so many suicides all in a row of my really close friends that I grew up with, fellow kid actors, that I just...
Who else besides Rusty Hamer?
Well, there was Rusty Hamer and Trent Lehman and Tim Hovey
So forgive me, I don't know who those other two are.
Oh, Please Don't Eat the Daisies, which was a family show.
Okay.
And Trent was in big movies like Major Dundee with Charlton Heston. You know, these were... But Rusty, of course, was the closest of all, because he had the 12 years on the Danny Thomas show, and you know, we raced cobras together and blah, blah, blah. And his death struck me particularly hard, because as a writer of books, and I had just, let me parenthetically say, I had already written a book about kid actors called Walt, Mickey, and Me. And I was on the lookout, like a lot of writers are. I was collecting life stories with an eye to making a book called, which would be called, A Minor Consideration. And, you know, I had 40 or 50 really good stories. And then Rusty's death was announced one morning in January.
What year was that?
That was 1990.
Uh-huh.
And I realized that it's one thing to talk about helping kid actors, and it's quite another if to actually do something.
Uh-huh.
And I turned to my wife that morning. It was like an image or a life path was revealed to me that morning in just a heartbeat. And I said to my wife, that will never happen again. And Rana knew just what I meant, because, you see, I knew that Rusty Hamer was in trouble. I knew where he lived. I had the freedom to stop in New Orleans and get a car and go see him. In fact, his brother had asked me to. And I just never got around to it. And his death made me realize you just can't talk about these things or feel bad for someone. The fact of the matter is, you get points when you show up.
Mm-hmm.
And since that day, when I hear about either a former kid star or a current kid star, for that matter, in trouble, I or someone else from this growing organization actually comes to the door. Knock, knock, knock. What's going on with you? How can I help?
That's really nice. That's really so. On a typical day, you know. How much do you do that, or how much does someone in the organization even know to do that?
Well, as you know, my day starts very early, and because Europe has a big film community, so by 5:30 in the morning, I'm starting to field calls and answering emails. Frankly, it's become global. Yesterday, I was sitting with a very disturbed mother whose son spent 3 years on a series, and like me, was fired from that series, and he's having a lot of difficulty adjusting to civilian life. And it's coming at a very painful time for him, because he's 15 years old and in high school, and he doesn't fit. Oh, surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
And I looked at this mother, who is an educator, and I said, what did you expect? Exactly, what did you expect? You know, in the women's movement, we learned in the 70s that old battle cry, you can have it all, is a falsehood.
Yeah.
You can't have it all.
Yep.
When people see these high-profile kids and think that their lives are normal, or worse, when they hear the child quoted or they see him on a talk show saying, oh, my life is just fine, you know, I take out the trash and clean the kitchen, you got to say to yourself, whoa, it isn't normal to be a high-income earner and famous. For a kid, it's not.
Yeah. Yep. Well, Okay, so your interest in helping kids, which was germinated with your own past, basically, and those of people who were good close to, has really expanded into being an advocacy for more than just child stars, right?
Well, it certainly has. I had no idea where this passion would lead me. But what I discovered early in the game, as we developed the resource base and acquired the tools and refined the tools to help this special category of kids, is that our particular skill set had applications to working kids everywhere. And I think one of the startling moments of my life, and anybody who gets a paycheck will appreciate this, I think. Back in 1938, Congress was debating and then subsequently passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that governs pretty much from a federal perspective the way we work, you know, hourly limitations, categories that are unsafe, et cetera, et cetera. Well, guess what? Inside this massive bill, which was passed in 1938, there are several exemptions. It's called the Newsy exemption. You see, William Randolph Hearst didn't want to have to pay straight time to the millions of children who delivered his newspapers all across the country.
Yeah.
And he asked for an exemption for newspaper and subscription magazine delivery kits.
Interesting.
And it was granted. Well, Hollywood knew a good thing when they saw it, and the moguls, who were very powerful in the late 30s, also approached their congressman and asked for an exemption to the kids in show business. So kids in show business were exempted from the provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Now, there was another group of people who approached the legislators saying, and they had a good case in 1938, asking for an exemption, and that was the American farmers whose children, of course, worked on the farm. So children in agriculture were granted an exemption to federal standards in terms of, you know, work working hour limitations, etc. So this I was so stunned when I saw that the kids in entertainment were exempted from federal standards, I immediately saw that's part of our problem. In California, for example, we have pretty good work rules for kids in the business. Not perfect, mind you, and we've been working on them with 5 pieces of legislation to improve things. But, you know, at the time we got started, 36 states had no regulations for children in the entertainment business.
Right.
So if a production company decided to go to Arizona or Nevada or North Carolina or Texas or Iowa, there were no child labor rules. So that's part of the mission that I'm on. I want those rules to be standard. And as I told you, the rules for the protection of animals are standard. We've all seen that at the end of a movie. No animal was killed or injured in the making of this picture.
Yeah,
we
see that all the time. Right?
Well, you know, it ought to say the same thing for children.
Wow, jeez. Okay, we're talking with Paul Peterson on the Saturday special on your favorite radio station, AM 1080 KSCO. It's 10:35. We're going to be on the air right up until 12 noon. If you want to give us a call and participate in this program, you're certainly welcomed and encouraged to do so. Phone numbers are 479-1080 or 477-1340 in area 831. If you want to send us a fax, our fax number is 475-2967. And if you want to shoot an email, you can send it to mz@ksco.com. It's not up right now, but I think we can bring it up here. But you can send me an email anytime. But give us a call if you want to participate. We're going to take a commercial break right now, and I'm going to go look at the lagoon. So stay with us, Monterey Bay, Silicon Valley. We will be right back.
We share this tiny planet with all sorts of creatures that wander its surface, creatures big and small. Some of the smallest, like bacteria, fungi, and yeasts, can seriously affect our bodies. Here's pharmacist Benjamin Fuchs to explain how.
Funguses and yeasts are sugar feeders. So right away you can tell that if you're eating a lot of sugar, you're eating a lot of refined carbohydrates, you're going to be feeding that fungus. Secondly, bacteria inside our intestines live in balance with fungus. And when bacteria are in balance with fungus, fungus can't overgrow. However, when bacteria levels drop, so-called good bacteria, then the fungus levels can rise. Bacteria and yeast live in the body in balance, and typically one doesn't overgrow over the other. However, when we drink chlorinated water, or we drink brominated water, or we eat preserved foods, we can kill off our intestinal bacteria. Also, by ingesting a lot of refined carbohydrates and sugars, we can have fungus overgrow because fungus and yeast are sugar feeders. Both of these in combination can result in fungus overgrowing in the body. So the answer is to take yourself some acidophilus and probiotics, build up that intestinal flora. Fermented foods are a wonderful way to build up the intestinal flora. So all of these strategies can help us rebuild our natural bacteria so the fungus kind of falls in line, all without drugs. Feeding the natural bacteria is a much better way.
American Longevity's Ultimate Killer Biotic incorporates a blend of mushroom extracts, bovine colostrum, and bee propolis, collected by killer bees from the surrounding Brazilian jungle. They used it to keep the hive free of bacteria, yeasts, and molds. And at $32.50 wholesale, you can boost your immune system without draining your bank account. Give your body what it needs to maintain a healthy balance of intestinal flora with Ultimate Killer Biotic from American Longevity. To order or to pick up American Longevity products, call Scott or Jose at KSCO Radio, 831-475-1080. That's 831-475-1080.
Hi, you guys. Did you know that American Longevity also has liquid glucogel? You know, that's the one that helps rebuild bone and cartilage, takes care of the bone matrix. They actually have a liquid glucogel that I add into my drink every single morning, and it really is loaded with goodies. It has 750 milligrams of glucosamine sulfate. This is in 1 ounce. Why not switch to the liquid glucogel? I use mine in the morning. I mix my liquid glucogel with my Ultimate Classic, my Osteo FX, and my Women's FX. I stir it up. It's a nice little yummy thing. You can almost chew on it. It's so thick. But it's delicious. It's sweet tasting. And oh my, it really packs a wallop. Oh, a wallop. That's a mistake, but actually it's a good one. It actually packs a wallop instead of a wallop. Anyway, you should do this. I drink the liquid glucogel every day. And don't forget, even an extra benefit, it has collagen. Call me, 888-352-7500, 888-352-7500.
Hi, I'm Dr. Guy Peabody. If fear is preventing you from seeing the dentist, listen to how we've helped others with sedation dentistry.
Hello, I'm Pat. I've had probably 40 years of dental drama and trauma, and usually I would go in for a dental procedure only when it was an emergency. Probably had about a dozen different dentists. None of them were painless. I would quit. I wouldn't follow up my procedures, and it would lead from one disaster to another. I would highly recommend Dr. Peabody to anybody that has any tension or apprehension about a dentist. He's the man, and I'm a true believer.
We've helped hundreds of people wake up to a beautiful smile. Let us help you, too.
Call Dr. Guy Peabody at 457-0343. That's 831-457-0343. Find Dr. Peabody's sedation dentistry on the web at drpeabody.com or in the Yellow Pages. You, too, can wake up to a beautiful smile.
Hello, I'm Robert Stangero. Many Santa Cruzans know me as Big Boy. The original Stangero family has been in business since 1879. Our name stands for quality, quantity, and great service. Our Gilda's restaurant on the Santa Cruz Municipal Wharf is still the fishing headquarters for the area. It's where fishermen gather every morning for coffee and breakfast before heading out on the bay. Stop by Gilda's and say hello. Both Gilda and I and my son Dino look forward to meeting you at Gilda's at the center of the Santa Cruz Municipal Wharf.
Hello, this is Tom Quinn, the host of Perspectives Radio Show. Every Saturday at noon, we give you cutting-edge news about current events. We interview well-known experts on a variety of issues, so listen in this Saturday from noon to 1 to Perspectives. Thank you.
Here at Good Morning Monterey Bay, we are here to help you. We realize that your morning drive could be slow and boring, but we try to make it more interesting and fun. We also realize the importance of communicating your feelings accurately and properly. Here are some innovative phrases that can help you on your morning drive. Try saying, King of the Hill traffic really helped me get to work on time. instead of, why the f*** am I stuck in traffic? Try saying, wow, this up-to-the-minute news really helps me stay on top of current issues. Instead of, Measure X, what the f*** is that? Try saying, Scott Free, Rosemary Chalmers, Wendy R., and Susan Simon sure are great to listen to. Instead of, this. Try saying, Good Morning Monterey Bay is a great way to get news, sports, traffic, and laughs first thing in the morning. Instead of, this isn't even helping. I can't even stand this piece of boring, dry on the radio.
Good morning, Monterey Bay, from 6 to 9 in the morning on KSCO. Good morning, Monterey Bay is a Rick and Bobby production.
And back to the Saturday special with your host, Michael Zwirling.
Hey, thank you there, Michael Williams there. And hey, we're talking with former Mouseketeer. I called him Jeff because I've known him as Jeff. I mean, he's always called Jeff. Jeff Stone from the Donna Reed Show, remember? You know, any of you remember the Donna Reed Show, you'll remember Jeff Stone. He's our guest, ladies and gentlemen. And just to prove it, I'm going to bring him back online here. And Jeff, am I right?
Well, you are absolutely right. And the funny part about this confusion of names is I still answer to Jeff. Honest,
probably more often than Paul, right?
Well, no, actually, you know, thank goodness life has gone on and people kind of, and I'm surprised by what I'm about to tell you. I have become so visible as an advocate for the rights of children in the entertainment and sports business that people kind of know what Paul Peterson does.
Okay.
Nonetheless, Jeff pops out in surprising circumstances. Last year when we passed some legislation in New York, Governor Pataki, as he was signing my bill, looked up at me and said, Jeff, you have to feel so proud right now. Now, his aides got all upset, you know, oh gosh, the governor misspoke, and I said to them, it doesn't matter what he calls me. I'm in the office. He's signing my bill.
Now, when you say your bill, are you ghostwriting these bills for legislators or what?
Oh, I'm actually putting pen to paper. Can you believe that of all the things that I have done in my life, it has resulted in a pretty decent skill for lobbying and passing legislation? And a very large component of our legislative record, which is 9-0 right now, no one has ever voted against the bills we have proposed and passed, is that the people I represent, Michael, they're famous. And when we talk about kids' issues, especially kids in show business, people understand that our credibility is unassailable. We have the T-shirt. We did this thing. And when we look at folks and say, hey, state of New York, where are your child labor rules for entertainment? They gulp, slap their head, and say, you mean we don't have them? Well, no, you don't. Let's fix that. And there has been, right from the beginning, an astonishing degree of cooperation from all quarters. And I'm going to include stage parents in this as well. The producers, legislators, the parents, the theatrical unions all have an interest in cleaning up this little corner of the world.
Well, that's good. That part's great. Okay. Hey, let's go to the phone lines, okay?
Sure.
Neil and Hollister, welcome to the KSCO Saturday Special with Paul Peterson and MZ. How are you?
Good morning, gentlemen. Well, this is really a trip down memory lane. Like most people my age, I watched Paul each week on the Donna Reed Show. And then, about 10 or 15 years later, I was in Philadelphia operating a business. And lo and behold, I see a picture of Paul in the newspaper in the form of an advertisement as part of one of these wannabe a star schemes.
Yes, indeed.
Essentially, you know, you come in and everybody pays $100. So I knew it was a scam, and I thought, well, his child's career is over, so he's trading in his reputation for a quick buck. And then some, maybe 10, 15 years after that, I saw Paul on a round table with Danny Bonaducci and a couple others, and it was so negative. And at that time, because of that ad situation being in my mind, I thought, well, perhaps this child actor issue is a pretext to get some face time on television for Paul. Well, here we go forward to 2005. I didn't catch the beginning of the show, so I didn't know who MZ's guest was, and I'm listening to Paul, not knowing it was Paul, and thinking, now that's not like that Peterson guy. This fellow is really sincere, and he's upbeat. Well, let me tell you, I am just absolutely delighted at the change in your attitude, your effectiveness. I'm dying to know how you possibly got involved with that that scam many years ago.
Maybe that was an imposter.
Well, no imposter. Although that having imposters step in for missing child actors is not unknown. But Neil, I very much appreciate your comments. In my defense, I will say this: life leads a thoughtful person on many paths, and some of them are not correct. And I was sold a bill of goods into the delivery of services by a group of people. The company was called Richart, which was trying to satisfy, they told me, the need for background performance and entry level on-camera performers in various regions. And it seemed like a good idea at the time. I have always worried about the way people get into the business. I worry about that today. And sadly, it was an operation that tarnished my reputation, and I felt horrible about it. The number of refunds that company had to make before they eventually disappeared was astonishing. But I played a role in getting those refunds back to people because the services promised weren't delivered. It's interesting that you know, life goes on and you learn more, you become more careful and guarded of your reputation, and more importantly, you begin to see that some of the things that you so stupidly tried to fix, because in the absence of having a good focus, the mistakes that you make along the way are part of the learning process.
Well, in hearing some of your comments earlier about the drug and alcohol phase, which I was unaware of, I thought possibly that was part of that.
Oh, of course it was. It was part of my life. Wasn't it part of yours? I mean, I meet the most amazing people who went through the 60s and 70s with me, who look me right in the eye and say, oh, I never got high. And I'm going, well, who were all those people?
No. I meant that you're getting involved with Richart at a time in your life when you were perhaps not thinking as clearly as you otherwise would have.
Well, that is true. You know, we're talking 35 years ago. I was in my mid-20s at that point. It was, I think everybody kind of recognizes when you look back at the late 60s and early 70s, that was a pretty turbulent time in our culture, and a lot of people made some bad choices.
I just like to say that you have thoroughly redeemed yourself in my eyes, and I am delighted for how effective and obviously happy you are.
Well, in fact, I am. Neil, I came finally to a point in my life where my grandfather's ancient wisdom became true. When I was 16 and on the Donna Reed Show, even though things were going great in my life, I wasn't really happy. And Grandpa and I shared a bedroom, and he looked at me one day and he said, "Paul, you got to find a job that you love. Then you'll never go to work a day in your life." And that's the point I'm at. I don't want to go to bed at night, and I can't wait to get up. Life has been pretty dramatic, and frankly, the progress that we've made has even astonished me. I never thought we would come to a time when I could effectively argue not only to the industry, but to stage parents and, frankly, all of America, that the child who does the work should own the money. I mean, that's a principle. I don't care what side of the political fence you're on. And one of the problems we have is that children, to this day, in all of the industrial world, are considered chattel. They are no different in the eyes of family law, and this is true throughout the supposedly civilized world. Children belong to their parents. And if they make a mistake in your upbringing, if they make a choice for you that involves sudden stardom or athletic achievement at a great cost, you got to live with that the rest of your life. And yet the money that you earn is the property of the parents. And you should see when I have my famous kid stars, when the parents go into court and argue over community property, the bulk of which is the income of their child. It's scary.
Well, I admire your energy, and I particularly admire what you've accomplished, and I'm particularly delighted to have had you go from somebody I thought in the back of my mind was a bit of a stinker to one of my favorite people.
Well, Neil, I appreciate that, and It's not over yet.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he might become a stinker again.
It's amazing. In the pursuit of this, I have found that I still have the capacity to tick people off.
Okay, well, I want to get into that in hour number two, if that's okay, Paul.
Sure.
Yeah,
thanks, guys.
Thank you, Neil. I don't know where the other callers are. Are they afraid to talk to a famous person or what? 479-1080 or 477-1340. What the hell?
What's going on?
My microphone broke off.
Oh, no.
What the hell is happening? You know, you're not supposed to complain about equipment at the radio station because it makes us sound bad.
Well.
But, I mean, it's ridiculous.
You know who to complain to, Michael.
Anyhow, I guess I'll just hold this. Can you hold it for me, Michael? So, well, let's start right now about you're quite a politico, aren't you?
Well, in fact, I
don't like boxes, right? You don't like to be put. You don't like labels any more than I do. But you're pretty conservative in some ways and pretty lefty in other ways.
Absolutely, and people have this notion that because I'm a pretty effective child advocate, well, I must be one of those wide-eyed liberals that people know all too well. And
you ain't.
I'm just the opposite.
You like Michael Savage, don't you?
I hope not exactly like him, but I'm not afraid to speak up, and I'll call a spade a spade.
I didn't say you are like Michael Savage. No. I said I think you like him as a talk host, or maybe.
I do. I'm tired of talk radio where people are mouthpieces for various political parties. Nobody is 100% right all the time. I understand that politics is compromise. And what I know, because my life has proved this to me, is that on about 80% of all issues that receive political attention, there is wide agreement. We all want our streets to be safe. We want our schools and universities to be just the best.
Most of us don't like pollution.
Well, exactly. I mean, the environmental issues. My family comes from the Midwest, and even though this ticks people off, I say to people, animals to me are inventory. And when it's your inventory, it's precious to you. It has value and worth. Who better to take care of the welfare of animals than those who husband them and profit from them? It's like duck hunters. We wouldn't have our national flyways and the wonderful reserves for waterfowl if it hadn't been for duck hunters.
Yeah, Ducks Unlimited.
Exactly. Uh-huh. They do a fantastic job.
Yeah, but what about PETA? Do you think they're sort of a little too extreme?
Well, I really worry about extremism in any form. Do you remember that wonderful longshoreman back in San Francisco?
Harry Bridges.
No, the Toffler. Hoffer. Eric Hoffer.
Oh, yeah, Eric Hoffer, sure.
Right, who wrote that book, The True Believer.
Yeah.
Well, I worry about anybody who becomes an extremist.
Uh-huh.
And that includes people who listen to shortwave radio and build their political opinions on that base.
Well, I was worried that you were going to say something bad about aminals because Doris Day lives in our area and she listens to this radio station mm-hmm. sometimes, or at least used to.
Yeah. Well, look, I have no brief against animals. I just... My perspective is that children might be a bit more important.
Right. Yeah, and a friend of mine once said that people are more important than salamanders because they were making it difficult for people to build if a salamander had lived on your property in the last million years or something.
Spotted owls or things like that.
Oh my God.
That really troubles me sometimes.
And it's getting worse. It really is.
Well, it is, and I hear the same things you hear, Michael, when folks say, 10 species are doomed to extinction every day in the Amazon rainforest, and I'm thinking, how many new species come into existence in the Amazon rainforest?
Yeah, they don't tell you that, do they?
No. They just don't. And I have been through, for example, in weather modification and the people who depend on government grants for weather. I remember when we were going to have an ice age. It was just 30-some years ago that the ice was coming. And that turned into global warming. And what I really see is the significant increase in federal grants to people who make a living off the weather.
Yeah, so, okay, global warming or global cooling, the weather's going to do what it's going to do, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, where did all those ice ages come from before humankind? had the capacity to affect the weather. And you're talking to a kid from Los Angeles who well remembers days when we couldn't go out on the playground during school because your lungs would fry.
Yeah, and you would be in danger of passing away.
And of course we want clean air and clean water. The trick is we've got to tell ourselves what the true cost is and then try to make progress. But not pretend cost. We can't say, oh, this is going to cost $1 billion when we know it's going to cost $20 billion. We've got to tell ourselves the truth.
What about the war?
Well, you're talking to a Navy dad, and I think I think there are principles and in the fight for natural resources that there comes a time when you have to fight. And I know when 9/11 happened, my son was in the Gulf on a Navy warship, and I supported this effort to finally look reality in the eye and say, you know something, we got a gunfight going on here. So I believe that this war is going to continue to be prosecuted, and I don't think it's going to go away, and I think, frankly, we're going to have the same timeline that we had in Europe. American forces are going to be in that region of the world for the next 30, 40 years. Get used to it.
Uh-huh. And are you irritated with what the media is doing these days to try to divide the country?
Well, I am. You know, this is Vietnam, is deja vu. I often say to people, we have to all kind of fess up to our mistakes. And I think the pattern of news reporting in Vietnam in particular clearly showed that a bias in the news can affect a war effort. And yet all of the
Excuse me, Paul, I want to make sure I'm understanding you.
Yeah.
You think then that the Vietnam experience, and I was in my 20s during Vietnam.
Well, hey, I turned 18 in 1963. You know, I was eligible for the draft.
Yeah, and so was I. And of course, I was against it from day one. We didn't belong there, besides the fact that I, you know, coveted my behind, you know. I just didn't think we had any business being there. You know, and there, of course, there are many people who are saying that right now.
Well, of course, and I appreciate that, except the warning, that political position carries with it a certain burden. In Vietnam, the folks who were opposed to that conflict were told over and over, if we don't stay the course, the dominoes will fall. Well, guess what happened? When we pulled out, the dominoes did, in fact, fall.
Yeah.
And that's what my friends on the left, I argue endlessly with them. You know, did Pol Pot come into existence or didn't he?
Yeah.
And people have to learn to count. I know it's horrible to contemplate the death of 500,000 people or 1 million. But you know what's worse to contemplate? 3 million.
Yeah.
5 million.
Yeah.
That's what's worse.
Right. Or the end of our way of life.
Well, and gosh knows we've got that capacity.
Yeah.
Although I will say, in the defense of humanity, when we get these weapons of mass destruction, it is almost a concomitant part of this development that our sense of responsibility grows enough so that we understand the horror of what we're talking about. You know, I wish the president had listened to me and some of my friends and taken the French approach when they pulled out of Algeria.
Good thing to talk about here. We're coming up on the top of the hour here on KSCO Santa Cruz. We'll be back in 6 minutes.
Fox News Radio. Walensky, potentially toxic chemicals turning up in Iraq. The U.S. military finding barrels and barrels under investigation. Exactly what's in them and who left them there.
The source that we spoke to with the military said they're still conducting an analysis. However, the chemicals that were found, if they are mixed in the method that was prescribed, they would have had, quote, a dangerous effect on coalition forces, Iraqi citizens, and security. And they would have had a lingering effect, his words, on the area.
Fox's William Lajeunesse in Baghdad. New constitution in Iraq, a draft of the document scheduled to be revealed Monday. Ultimately, it will become the law of the land.
The establishment of a democratic constitution is a critical step on the path to Iraqi self-reliance. Iraqis are taking control of their country, building a free nation that can govern itself, sustain itself, and defend itself. And we're helping Iraqis succeed.
President Bush during his weekly Saturday radio address. making it easier to get through an airport. The Washington Post reporting today the TSA is toying with the idea of getting rid of some of those current restrictions that are in place in the nation's airports.
The TSA looking possibly to lift the carry-on ban on items such as scissors, razor blades, knives, all less than 5 inches long, as well as ice picks, throwing stars, and bows and arrows. Now, the TSA basically determining that these are the items that pose the least risk for passengers to carry on into their luggage.
Fox's Rebecca Gomez.
We have to deal with it, but it's really killing us.
And limo drivers laying down the dollars to fill up their tanks after oil hit $67 a barrel Friday. Gas for regular unleaded this morning, topping $3 a gallon in some cities. I'm Robin Walensky, and you're listening to Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Think carefully. Do you remember what you had for breakfast this morning? Do you remember where you're supposed to be this afternoon? Do you remember the first question? Our children, your child, may not. Because every day the chances of becoming a victim of mercury poisoning increase. Mercury poisoning may cause neurological damage that impairs learning, language development, vision, and memory. And mercury itself has become part of our everyday lives, absorbed by certain fish, taken into our bodies, and passed on to our children like a common cold. But you can stop this. Log on to earthshare.org and find out how. Will you remember that? A public service message brought to you by EarthShare of California and the Ad Council.
Digesting the difficult 9/11 tapes.
Where we're being told a second plane crashed into the building on the opposite end.
That's not an accident. That's on purpose.
Relatives who lost loved ones in the terror attack of 9/11/01 say it is so hard to hear the chaos on these new radio transmissions. They were released yesterday by the New York City Fire Department. Sally Regenhard lost her son, who was a New York City firefighter. She was a guest on Fox and Friends this morning.
We have an obligation not to put our head in the sand and say everything was fine, but to look at the failures of 9/11 when it comes to New York City, lack of emergency preparedness, emergency management, emergency communications, failure of firefighter radios. This could happen in any other city.
And up in smoke in Washington State, wildfires destroying 100 homes. The raging fire burning across 50,000 acres. Some summer cabins burning to the ground. They were wood. The fire about 40 to 50% contained, we're told. More than 1,000 firefighters still trying to put it all out. Well, come on, Irene, the tropical storm heading for hurricane status.
Tropical storm Irene is a still strong tropical storm with maximum sustained winds near 70 miles per hour. So it's not too far from becoming a hurricane, but it's not there yet.
Richard Knapp with the National Hurricane Center in Miami.
We think it's going to make a turn to the north and then eventually to the northeast early next week. So chances are it's going to curve out to sea before hitting the United States directly.
And bada bing. You know the song, and guess what? You're going to be getting a lot more of the show. The Sopranos not only returning to the air for a sixth season in March of 2006, but 8 bonus episodes have been added for 2007. Creator David Chase saying he felt there were just more mob stories to be told. I'm Robin Walensky, Fox News Radio.
KSCO 1080 on your dial.
That's right, you're listening to AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz. I'm Michael Williams. It is Saturday, August 13th, 2005. It is currently 11:05 a.m. here. On the bay today, we've got west winds 5 to 15 knots, wind waves 1 to 3 feet, northwest swell 2 to 5 feet at 8-second intervals. Areas of morning fog as well. And tonight, west winds 5 to 15 knots, wind waves 1 to 3 feet as well. Northwest swell 2 to 5 feet at 8 seconds, and areas of fog continuing through the night. Portions of today's program are brought to you by University Test Prep. The new SAT is tough, so get prepared now. Enroll in the last SAT boot camp before school starts, August 15th, 19th at Scotts Valley Middle School. Call University Test Prep at 335-7600. Now we take you to hour two of the Saturday special with your host, Michael's Whirling.
Oh, hello, darling. I hate to hang up on you, but I'm sorry, baby, but I have to go. It's time for that wonderful record show. I'd love to visit, but you'll have to call back.
All right, I know I shouldn't do this, but what's wrong with you people? Golly gee, I mean, how often do you get to talk to a Mouseketeer? Where are all the callers? I expected there to be thousands of you without impossible to anybody else to get in. Where are you all?
I'm sorry, baby, but I really gotta go to KSCO Radio.
Maybe it's like what's happened a few times where the guest has been so riveting and interesting that nobody wants to knock us off track by even calling in, you know, right? Maybe that's probably what's going on here. Hopefully that's what it is. All right, welcome to hour number two of the KSCO Saturday Special. My name is MZ. We've got a special guest, Paul Peterson, well-known actor, child star, actually was a Mouseketeer, was probably best known for being... Jeff Stone in the Donna Reed show that ran for, I believe, 8 years in the 50s and 60s. And he's our special guest today. And we're going to continue with our discussion of politics right after we hear this latest commentary from Kay.
The following is a KSCO commentary. Here is Kay's Whirling.
Weighing in on the national current debate of random searches versus profiling, I emphatically cast my vote for profiling. Random searches, used at all airports and subways, where every fifth person is searched, is an exercise in stupidity. For example, person number four may fit the profile of a human bomb, young, between 18 to 35, dark skin, hair, and eyes, while person number five turns out to be an asthmatic, slow-walking, fat, 88-year-old female. She gets the thorough inspection, while the suspicious-looking number four walks away right into the possible ill-fated plane or train. It is way past time to stop fighting a kind and gentle war. We refuse to target traveling Islamic-looking Americans while we are willing to put all Americans in danger. That's idiotic. I believe the Islamic Americans, without any evil agenda, should be willing to put up with selective body examinations under the present circumstances. Whoever said that life is fair? The vocal left say that they are against the war in Iraq, but they are for supporting the troops. That's bullpucky. Their constant whining and complaining are giving aid and comfort to the enemy and hurting the morale of the very troops they claim to support. To them I say, you can't have it both ways. Please understand that for us, winning is a must and it is not negotiable. So put aside your personal rights and personal privacy for the time being. Please, even if you are against this war, stifle your protests and let us close ranks and fight as a united country. I want my grandchildren's children to have a life worth living. The world is watching us. The stakes are high. The outcome will decide whether it will be a dark world or a free world. We can't not win. For KSCO and KOMY, this is Kay's Whirling.
Heavy stuff, but right on. Let's see. Did you hear that, Paul?
Oh, there's a lady who knows what she's talking about.
And she's mine. And she's my ma.
You lucky guy.
Yeah, it's true.
You lucky guy.
Yeah, no, she minces no words here.
Well, it's common sense.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that wonderful Yale University study on the mentally ill. They got a bunch of people, and they parceled out their therapy to different groups. One-third went to psychologists, one-third went to psychiatrists, and one-third went to Jewish grandmothers. And guess which group came out improving the most? Those who were given to Jewish grandmothers. Isn't that, I mean, it's so obvious.
Well, great. Here's Paul Peterson, ladies and gentlemen. He's an interesting dude. Much more so, I think, actually, for his outlook on the world. You can't put this guy in a box than his incredible background in Hollywood. Give us a call if you want to talk. 479-1080 or 477-1340. It's your favorite radio station, AM 1080 KSCO. With Michael Z and Paul P. Here's Joe and Salinas. Hey, wait a second. I think I, Paul, are you still there?
I'm still here. Okay. You didn't lose me.
I probably lost the other man here.
Oh, gosh.
Here. Okay, now I think we are. Are you there, Joe?
Yeah, this is Joe.
Good. Hey. All right, go. You're on the air, Joe.
How are you, Joe? Yeah, Mike, your mom is the Donna Reed of the Central Coast. She's fantastic. She's our queen, and we love her. The loyal subject.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
Your guest, I just stumbled into the program, and I've been running around, but it was mother's milk to my ears to hear someone with common sense and maturity talking about the political situation, about the deaths that occurred in Vietnam. After we left, we just washed our hands of it. I mean, it's immoral for us to leave. We cannot leave. We owe it to those people across the world who have no chance for freedom and stuff. It's our responsibility, and that's something that was taught to us in school. All of us at our age was taught this responsibility that we had to liberate people, and that hasn't been taught in school for the last 30 years.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Joe. I believe, Michael, I shared my thoughts about education these days. My father would be turning in his grave knowing the state of education in America today. When I went to school in the mid-50s in the Los Angeles Unified School District, I went to Fair Avenue Grade School, for example. That was the number one school in the number one district, in the number one state, in the number one nation in the world. And today, California, even though it improved under Governor Davis to 36, not so many years ago, we were tied with Mississippi, and our country was ranked 21st in the world. Now, who the heck is going to claim responsibility for that decline?
The liberals. The liberals won't claim it, but they're the ones responsible.
Well, of course not. Of course not. And all the competent educators building on the English model, which requires discipline and demands excellence of the students, no matter what their capabilities, building on that model, just 50 years ago, we were the beacon of the world. And guess who just happened to run education then?
Well, because they've lost the center of what ethics is about. It's about belief in a loving God, this Christian God, Judeo-Christian God, who is the foundation of Western civilization.
Well, I think so. As a practicing Christian, the truth of the matter for me is not that this is a quote-unquote superior religion until you look at the results. And, having a faith system that permits not only forgiveness, but if necessary, also permits the fight, is part of my nature. I would have to be hard-pressed before I would resort to violence. And I think this nation needs to be far more creative in the way we combat these forces of darkness. I alluded before the top of the hour to the French model in Algeria. When the Algerian nationalist movement wanted the French kicked out, the French said, okay, they took their locomotives, they took the telephone exchanges, all the things, all the modern things that they had given this country, and in 2 years, even the Algerian nationalists were begging for France to come back. And frankly, I think we ought to be putting one whale of a quarantine on those forces in the Middle East, governments or individuals, who use technology that they haven't invented. Like, okay, you don't want to have airplanes and cell phones and television and radio and stuff. We will happily do help you not have them anymore and see if you like it.
Well, how about this? You know what? Why don't we do that to our own country? All these people who think that we are so evil here, why don't we take away their cell phones, their telephones, their cars, their showers, all the benefits that this Western society has provided? All these people who think we're no good, they shouldn't reap those benefits either, and maybe they'll understand what a Judeo-Christian nation, which provides.
Well, it doesn't even have to be faith-based. You know, I do a lot of heavy lifting in the theatrical unions here in Hollywood, and the hypocrisy that I deal with these people who make these astonishing claims to a superior morality or lifestyle, and I look at them and I go, you make nothing but trash. You are making product that you won't even let your own children see. I mean, how can you say that you are pursuing something noble?
That's right. They send their kids to private schools. They wouldn't dare put their kids in the hands of people who teach what they believe.
Well, and
why aren't we getting any calls from those kinds of people?
Well, I wonder.
Because they're cowards, because they're in the presence of...
Well, there was one who called. There was one who called who was short on time, and I didn't want to cut it on the road. Billy, who was on the road. Now, mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the Billy that calls here, or it's a different Billy. But he was short on time, and so I guess Joe was on a roll, and I guess I should have cut Joe off because we lost Billy.
No, okay. Well, this is the fun of talk radio.
Yeah.
You know, the truth is, over the long haul is when you get the fullness of a person's opinion.
Yeah.
And what I have discovered, and mind you now, my television sister, Shelley Fabre, is married to Mike Farrell.
He's quite the lefty activist,
well,
isn't he?
But he is a well-mannered, thoughtful man, which means the debate never gets rancorous.
Uh-huh.
And that's fine with me.
Right.
I like recreational debate.
Right.
Because I think out of that comes consensus.
Right. What do you think about Fox News Channel?
Well, I watch them. I guess I vote with my viewing habits. What a relief, finally, to get that kind of... It's better. Is it perfect? Not at all.
Uh-huh.
Not at all.
I like to watch it, but every once in a while, quite frequently, there's people talking over each other, you know.
That part I don't like.
Yeah.
You know, I touched briefly with you, Michael, on the fact that I have sort of translated it into an advocacy for the rights of seniors. And I have a television show down here in Los Angeles called Aging in L.A.
Yeah.
Because I think these issues regarding seniors, about long-term care, as the baby boomers arrive at old age, that we got to get a handle on them. And I have used...
I'll drink to that.
Well, you know, you have an 84-year-old mom. I've got an 82-year-old mom and four other elderly ladies. And these issues, if we don't face them, if we don't tell ourselves the truth about this incredible extension of our life expectancy, it's going to bankrupt this country. It certainly threatens already to bankrupt many health plans and pension plans of the various unions across the land.
True.
And that's an issue, I think, where without rancor, that you can have people who are very, very liberal and believe in a government solution, and people who think that, you know, we have a pretty wonderful health care system, and if you haven't made enough money to take care of yourself in your old age, well, poo on you.
Not a nice thing to say.
No, and I think there's a middle ground here. But what we have to first do is recognize that this is a $1 trillion problem. This isn't chump change. This is big time. I know my family is currently saddled with the five elderly women I mentioned just a moment ago, with $13,300 per month in costs. Now, that most people couldn't handle that, and it takes the entire family's resources in order to cover this. But that's the nut. And guess what? It could happen to me tomorrow. I could have the stroke. I could have the heart attack. And then I'm in that box. And I apologize for that person trying to ring in.
No. I'm just ridiculing the person because they're no. What do they think we're going to do? We're going to stop somebody when they're on a roll? By the way, Joe, thanks very much for your call to the Saturday special. Okay.
Thank you for having a wonderful guest.
All right. Thank you, Joe.
Here comes a blank whose name is not. It's question mark on the screen.
No question mark.
Yeah. Who is this? Hello. You're on the air. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah. You're on. Whoever you are.
That's not me, Michael.
Oh, no. Okay, well, we'll just drop it down here.
I wonder. I like your attitude that we are so compelling and arresting that people just can't be motivated to grab their phone.
No, I mean, I feel like I have egg on my face. I was bragging to you about this 10,000-watt radio station about Monterey Bay and Silicon Valley, and there's like three phone calls. I thought it would be jammed, you know?
Well, have you ever seen those wonderful debates, especially at the college level, when the speakers are on their own quite capable of stunning you into silence.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I better listen here. And right. That happened to me once back in 1964. I went to a convocation on education at the Beverly Hilton, and there were many people who were talking about the need for specialization, specialization, specialization. And then came Jacob Bernowski, who strolled back and forth across the stage in his rumpled old brown suit, and he said things like this: if you can put a man on the moon and you haven't read Shakespeare, you're an ignoramus. He argued
and
exactly.
And he's absolutely right.
Oh, of course he is, and that's part of our problem. We have far too many people who are specialists and don't either see the larger picture or frankly think that they're not part of it.
Now, I have not personally read Shakespeare, but at least I'm honest about admitting that, but nor have I put anybody on the moon.
Well, interestingly enough, my background, my father, quite a few members of my family worked in the Skunk Works at Lockheed, so they were at the kind of cutting edge of that technology. And yet, at the same time, my television father, Carl Betz, was a student and then a graduate of Carnegie Mellon University, and in fact, won the Carnegie Award, sharing it with Robert Ludlum. Back in the day. And our lunches, once I turned 14 and he got me the complete works of Shakespeare, were filled with readings of Shakespeare. Carl doing it from memory, and me as a 14-year-old struggling not only with the words but the concepts, reading it from the book.
Oh my.
And what a treat to have that influence in my life.
And now, was Carl Betz your television father?
Yes.
Was he sort of like a real father in that regard? I mean, did you have that close a relationship with him, like your own dad, or not necessarily?
Well, I didn't have that closeness with my real dad because, of course, my life took this path, which separated me, frankly, from my family.
Right.
I mean, my core beliefs, I grant to my father and grandfather. But Carl was a different kettle of fish. He was much different than what I was led to be, a man's man. But at the same time, Donna Reed was married to a very gruff, tough talking guy from the south side of Chicago named Tony Owen, and I adored him. He was fun.
Weren't you telling me that that Donna Reed herself was pretty left wing, and as a youngster you would regularly have political arguments with her, which was fascinating?
Yes, and it was fascinating. Donna Reed was one of the co-founders of Common Cause and Another Mother for Peace. So you can imagine, when I got my first draft notice, this is 1983, September, here I am on a television show, and Donna has another son from her real family, Tony, who is my age, and he got his draft notice at the same time. And, you know, she didn't want to lose her boys. It was the darndest thing, so she really became motivated. Most of Hollywood tilts to the left. Of course, these days, I think they've run off the cliff. They're not tilting. They are in free fall.
We have three people on the phone lines. Now, let's go to the serial faxer. Here, serial, you're on the air.
Gentlemen.
Hi there, serial.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to accidentally bring the show, the intellectual part of the show, to a grinding halt for just a second.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
Big fan of yours growing up, Paul.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me this. Did you have family friends that you visited in the summertime in San Jose when you were younger?
Oh, I sure did. Eddie Sachs and his family.
How about the Newcombs?
The Newcombs were there. Also, Scott Owen, who remains a close friend. We came up to, you know, Lockheed had transferred a whole bunch of people up to Sunnyvale. And, of course, I'm a Lockheed kid, so we were regular visitors. We'd come up and see all those folks. It was great. I loved the area.
Here's why I asked. When I was a kid, of course, you were like it for me during the show, you know?
I see.
And I thought you were great, and of course, like everyone else, I was totally in love with Shelley.
Of course.
Okay, and I held you guys in awe. Well, apparently, I was riding in the car with my mom. We went around the corner onto Westgate Avenue where the Newcombs live.
Uh-huh.
And who did we hit with our car but Paul Peterson, who was riding a Vespa.
Yes, that's right. That was Scotty's Vespa.
Can you imagine how I felt when my mom hit my childhood idol with a car?
Oh, isn't life funny?
Isn't that something?
Well, it really is. You know, I have always considered California my backyard, and since I love cars and I don't mind a 5 or 6 hour drive, I just kind of make it my business to take off. My wife and I do it to this day. You know, we'll run off to Napa and see relatives, or go up to see John, or drive to Vegas at the drop of a hat.
Well, you simply must stop by here on one of these trips. Stop by KSCO.
Hey, are those two streets still gated there?
Yep.
Are they?
In fact, my aunt lives there. Cottle and Westgate, my aunt lives on one of them. They still have the little white gate.
I'll be darned. Well, Scotty Owen's parents, I believe, have passed on. And Scotty's living in Capitola now.
I'll be darned.
But I get around there.
I just want to say it's great to hear someone with your history and status to be articulate, interesting, down to earth, nice human being. It's really refreshing.
Well, thank you, Cyril.
Well,
thank
you. I appreciate those words.
Great program, you guys.
Thanks. Thank you.
I'll see you later. Here comes Ole. Is it Ole? How do you say your name?
It's Ole.
Okay. Hi,
Ole. Hi, Ole. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm Rosemary's neighbor. You're already doing what I hoped you would do, which is talk about the memories of your show, and I want to know if you still sing My Dad.
Wait a minute. Is this Harold?
Harold?
Is this Harold trying to put on some... we have a band caller who will do anything to get on the line.
No, this is Rosemary's neighbor, Ole.
Oh, you sound so much like Harold forcing...
I don't know.
I'll be darned. You know, Ole, I don't sing My Dad very often, and let me tell you why. That song is really special to me. I got to sing it. Most people remember two Carl Betts on the show.
Right.
And Carl has passed away. My biological father, Doc, has passed away. My favorite father-in-law of all time, Charlie Platt, has passed away.